That's kind of hard to answer, you know, because migraine is such a complicated neurologic disorder that it's sometimes hard to say what was specifically caused by migraine, what was caused by the comorbidities that come with migraine and that also contribute to migraine.
Ever find yourself foggy, forgetful, and not as sharp as you would like to be during or after a migraine attack? In addition to the pain, nausea, and sensory issues we face with an attack, we often notice cognitive symptoms. How does migraine affect cognitive abilities like memory? Did the deficiencies persist over time? Do migraine medications make things worse or better? Are there ways to reverse any potential damage and to improve the brain? To help us answer these questions is Dr. Jack Shim. Dr. Shim is board certified in neurology and has certification in headache medicine by the United Council of Neurologic Subspecialties. Dr. Shim is chair of the Division of Neuroscience at Scripps Hospital, Encinitas, and a past president of the Association of California Neurologists and an active member of the American Academy of Neurology and American Headache Society. He is a board member of the Headache Consortium of the Pacific. Dr. Shim, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So glad to have you. We are learning more and more about the pathophysiology of migraine. Does our new knowledge shed some light on the cognitive symptoms that come with it, including memory loss?
Well, absolutely. You know, over time, we've had many patients report to us that they just feel foggy and can't think. And certainly in the midst of a migraine, that's never been particularly surprising. But we also see people who tell us that they just don't feel right even in between. And there's more information suggesting that, at least in some people, that is not just related to their medications, which we also see as a problem.
Does the migraine cause the cognitive issues?
That's kind of hard to answer, you know, because migraine is such a complicated neurologic disorder that it's sometimes hard to say what was specifically caused by migraine, what was caused by the comorbidities that come with migraine and that also contribute to migraine.
Does decreased cognitive functioning come with a lot of different types of chronic pain?
Well, we see that certainly with back pain and knee pain, and any kind of chronic pain commonly has that. Fibromyalgia is a great example of, while we really don't understand it, I think in general we're starting to learn that it is a disorder of central pain processing or modulation, and many of my patients who have fibromyalgia tell me about their fibro fog.
So it is with other conditions as well.
I would think so, yes.
Yes, okay, great. And does chronic pain damage the brain? And I want to even get into this a little bit more detail as we go, but you know, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I was reading a little bit about that recently, and first of all, it's somewhat controversial. There is certainly evidence in many imaging studies that people with chronic pain have alterations in specific areas of the brain. Whether that's caused by the pain or whether that is contributing to the pain is really tough to tease out. But there are certainly areas of the brain that can be shown in people, for example, with migraine that have lower volume or greater volume that may be aspects of cognition. We know that people with migraine can have iron deposition in the brainstem, and whether that's a cause or trigger and contributes to the difficulty in modulating pain or whether that's a consequence of the pain, thus far we really have trouble parsing that out.
So chicken versus the egg situation in some cases.
I think so.
Well, what studies have been done looking at the cognitive impairment that may come with migraine, whether it caused it or came before or after?
Well, so there have been population studies that have looked at impairments both reported and then tested. And when you look at the population studies of people with migraine, by and large, it doesn't look like there's a difference when they're not having an attack. When you look at clinic-based studies, it seems that that's not necessarily true. And so it might be part of the shift of someone who goes from being someone suffering from migraine in the community to becoming a patient and starting treatment and so forth. And that also gets tangled with the medications that we often use for migraine. So for example, I'll tell you of a patient of mine. A couple of years ago, a young woman, about 35 or so, came to see me, and her major complaint was about her memory. It turned out she had chronic migraine. She told me her memory was so bad that she had actually forgotten to pick her kids up from daycare. I said, that's pretty bad. said, well, we need to put you on something because your headaches are just completely out of control. And I put her on topiramate, a commonly used migraine preventive. It sometimes has cognitive side effects, and I warned her about that. When she came back, she said, my headaches are gone and my memory's back to normal. Wow, I didn't expect that.
Right, yeah. That's a great result.
Yeah.
That's a great result. I'm glad to hear that story. I'd like to talk a little bit more about memory loss later too, because we got a lot of questions about that from our viewers.
Yes.
But first, if we could, let's talk about brain fog. You know, that it's a little bit hard to describe in some ways, but I think we all know what it is too. But what is it? And scientifically, what is happening when we have brain fog?
Let's start off with, I don't really know, and I'm not sure that anyone truly does. I just saw an article a couple of days ago, and it wasn't specifically about migraine, but it was talking about how inflammation alters processing, mental and cognitive processing. And they had done an experiment where they took a group of volunteers and they injected them with a vaccine that caused a measurable degree of inflammation, did a blood test and showed that inflammatory markers were raised. And it was sham controlled. Some of the people got saline, others got the vaccine, and then they switched. And they measured cognitive processing speeds, and they found problems with focus and attention related to the inflammation. And they could correlate the degree of difficulty with attention with changes in brain waves. They didn't do a structural brain imaging because it was an acute inflammatory thing. But they were relating it to the fog and fatigue that people get when they're ill. When people have migraines, they're sick, right? During a migraine, we've called it a sick headache forever. And we're starting to get a little better handle on that. We know that inflammatory markers can be elevated. We certainly know that the process of migraine in the brain can be triggering inflammation. Our newest medications that are targeting the calcitonin gene-related peptide pathway, we know that at least CGRP, one of its aspects is that it can cause local inflammation. So if inflammation is part of migraine, it's not too surprising that if inflammation can alter our cognition, our concentration, that's going to be a problem. Because if you can't concentrate, you're not going to be sharp. You're not going to be able to multitask. In fact, you're going to have trouble even just reading a newspaper and registering and relating what it was that you just read.
Absolutely, and I've been there myself, so I definitely understand that. But it makes sense to make that link to inflammation as well. So that's helpful. So we do ask our viewers for topics and for questions, and we had a lot on this topic area. But one of our viewers in particular, named Aaron, asks, the effects of brain fog, no ability to concentrate, forgetfulness, profound fatigue, and struggling with words are more debilitating than me than just the pain. And in my experience, have worsened greatly as my migraines have become more chronic. Why would this be?
I think we've registered and recognized for a long time that during a migraine, people are very impaired. When I first started getting interested in migraine, I recognized that during migraines, my patients were about as sick as the patients that I was taking care of who had had a severe brainstem stroke. If someone has chronic migraine, their brain never gets to reset. If you have someone who has migraine, let's say, once every couple of months, a very infrequent migraine sufferer, there's quite a bit of time for the whole process of migraine that has influenced brain function to normalize and get back to that person's normal, which is probably normal. If you think about the typical duration of a migraine attack, including the premonitory phase, the pain phase, and the migraine hangover phase, where people say, I feel like I was run over by a bus, that's commonly 3-4 days. You know, when we think about the definition of migraine and it's 4 hours to 3 days, well, yes and no. If someone has 2 attacks a week, which is 8 days of migraine possibly, or might be more, they're never really getting to hit the full reset button on their nervous system. And that's someone who is going to be certainly diagnosed as chronic migraine, hopefully, meaning hopefully they actually get diagnosed and treated.
Does that also suggest that the inflammation levels are staying high as well, that we're kind of staying inflamed? Does that make sense?
Well, I don't think we have information that would show that total body inflammation is increased during a migraine attack. But when we look at the data regarding the links of CGRP to migraine, for certain during attack, there's elevated CGRP, And we have evidence that some people who have New Daily Persistent Headache, which is commonly a migraine phenotype, if you will, meaning the people have the experience of migraine, but they have a day. I was fine until April 15th, and it wasn't just the taxes. And I've only had one headache in my life. It's just a four-year-long headache at this point. There's evidence that spinal fluid measures of inflammation can be elevated. And that's been shown a few years ago, actually, by Dr. Rosen. I don't necessarily do spinal taps on everyone who has New Daily Persistent Headache, but I think that's one little piece of signal that says inflammation is a significant part of migraine, and it's not necessarily the whole story, but that inflammation may be driving people's pervasive cognitive symptoms.
So this may be related, but another viewer said that when she's having a migraine attack that she can't form new memories. You know, and won't even remember if she watched a movie. She might not even remember that she watched it. You know, why would that be happening?
Well, again, I'm going to have to speculate because I don't really think we have clear data, and I certainly don't know fully, but you can just start off by thinking about how dysfunctional people are during a migraine. The light is hurting. Their stomach is upside down. Their head is throbbing. Just the least bit of sound is painful. I couldn't watch a movie or TV if I was in that state. And if I did, there's no way in the world I would remember anything about it. So I'm not sure whether it's fully the memory issue or you're just in such a neurologically disturbed state from the migraine attack.
That makes sense completely. And I can definitely relate to that for sure. So let's talk about the cognitive impacts, if we can, in the different stages of a migraine, as you mentioned earlier. But I'd like to know if there are differences with the stages. So first of all, I guess with prodrome, what are the cognitive impacts that you typically see there?
It's very difficult to concentrate when you're feeling dizzy, when you're feeling nausea. You may not be throbbing at all yet, but you know that you're not functioning well. And I think that is probably the attention aspect. Because if you can't lay down, if you can't concentrate on something, you can't lay down new memories. And we've seen that for a long time in many areas in neurology. Once we shift into aura, we know that that is related to the process of cortical spreading depression. And while we can speak to that in terms of people who have symptoms of aura, dazzle and so forth, I think there's still the unanswered question of whether people who don't experience aura still have that physiologic process, and it may be happening in deep brain centers like the thalamus, the medial temporal lobes that are very involved in memory processing. So you can imagine that if the first aspect of migraine includes changes in brainstem function, and now we're starting to have impact on areas that are memory related, and maybe it's aura, maybe it isn't. Light hurts, you can't concentrate, you're starting to feel dizzy, and you're asking me to read a report to you or complete a report or work on big monitors because I'm an analyst on Wall Street. Then we go into the severe pain aspect, and not everyone with migraine has severe pain. And for that matter, of course, we can diagnose migraine with no pain whatsoever. People who have migraine aura without pain. That can be disabling. I've had a gentleman years ago, a surgeon who had to go on full disability because he had aura, no pain whatsoever. You can just imagine if he's in the operating room looking through a microscope while he's doing a neck dissection. He says, I think there's a blood vessel there, but all I can see is sparkles and now my visual field is disappearing. Tap, tap, I better scrub out. In the postdrome, I'm not sure that we really understand that much about what's going on, but I think inflammation is a big part of it because you think about the whole CGRP-related story. That, I think, is when people say, I feel like I was run over by a bus, the pain isn't there, but I'm very fatigued, kind of thinking back to that inflammatory markers, interleukin 6 kind of story. I still feel exhausted from the last 2 days, the last 6 hours, however long things were quite bad. And then on top of that, we add in the treatments that we have. Our medications, unfortunately, are far from perfect. Triptans, while they're certainly the mainstay of acute treatment for most people with migraine, are really desirable and successful for 50-70% maybe. One of my good friends lives up the street from me, has migraine, and I had recorded a description of her experience over the last year or so as we were changing preventives and so forth. And she says, well, so I get a migraine. I have to decide whether I can take a triptan or not, meaning can I handle the medicine or is it better if I just tough through the migraine? Because once I take the triptan, I have to lay down. I can't function for an hour or two. So that in and of itself is very disruptive.
I make that decision sometimes. I absolutely know what she means. And I'd like to go back to two things that you said that stuck out at me that I really hadn't heard before. And one of them was you talked about with aura. You know, I think we understand kind of what, you know, we typically think of when we think of aura. I don't personally think I have aura. But it was interesting you said that actually there may be some similar things going on even with people that don't have aura, you know, the way it's defined. Could you just speak to that again for a minute?
Well, you know, my understanding of aura in terms of the physiologic process, I think helps explain visual changes, tingling and numbness, difficulty with speech, temporary aphasia, weakness, maybe even what we consider migraine, vertigo, or migraine with brainstem type aura. In other words, is that just the shift of that physiologic process to a different part of the brain? And I've always been intrigued by our difficulty in explaining the next step from migraine aura to migraine pain, because now we can talk about pain and, you know, the signaling of and so forth. And so it's always been a question of, for those people who don't experience aura that they can talk to us about, but they still experience all sorts of things that cognitive and fatigue and so forth, is that perhaps, and, you know, speculation is sort of sitting around at dinner talking about it kind of speculation, rather than an area where I'm aware of any specific data, is that perhaps aura process occurring in areas that are non-eloquent, meaning we have difficulty putting a word to it. But that could certainly involve areas of brainstem function, of the hypothalamus that relates to fatigue, to temporal lobe function that relates to memory impairments.
Very interesting. And you touched on this as well, but the fatigue, you know, that comes especially at the end of an attack, you know, what explains that? That even when you're over the pain and you should be feeling euphoric, you know, it's a little dampened because you're so tired, you know, what's caused?
Honestly, I don't know. And for that matter, I've heard people take their triptan and say, it relieved things so much that I was crystal clear, hyper clear. And so that kind of brings up, you know, what is migraine all about in a, let's say, teleologic sense, and why is such a disabling condition, which is commonly genetically linked, so prevalent? You would think evolutionarily that would dampen it out. So there's aspects of migraine that are, I think, really, really intriguing and not well understood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, back to the memory loss that comes with it, why does the memory loss seem to linger for some people even in between attacks and, you know, perhaps even for an episodic person or even for someone that's chronic but they, you know, have breaks in between attacks? You know, why would that memory loss seem to persist?
I have patients who tell me about subjective memory loss, and sometimes we will put them through neuropsychometric testing. We have several neuropsychologists as part of our practice. Almost always they test normally. So it's really a matter of perceived memory impairments, and there's a lot that feeds into that. If you think about the other common comorbidities, so anxiety and depression are common with migraine, and people who have depression can have what we term a pseudo-dementia, where their concentration, their ability to make effort to learn something or to do something is impaired by their mood state. And migraine and mood are intricately intertwined. In fact, for that matter, the definition of pain includes the affective and emotional aspects reaction to the perception of tissue damage. Another aspect I think we can relate to is poor sleep. Common migraine trigger. If I see someone who has migraine and they give me any information about morning headache, which is probably two-thirds of people with migraine, I say, well, let's do a little more careful sleep history. Hey, I'm going to refer you internally to our sleep doctor. She'll take a long sleep history, because if you're not sleeping well, that's a cognitive drag right there, and then you're falling asleep during the daytime, and we know that we're not learning very much during sleep. I mean, there's a lot of processing that's occurring, and sleep is a whole different interesting area that affects memory, pain, and so forth. But if we think about all of those issues and we think about the medicines that we use, and many of our preventive medicines have central nervous system side effects. So for example, fatigue is a common side effect with some of the antidepressants that are used as migraine preventives. Beta blockers can cause fatigue. Anticonvulsant category medicines can cause fatigue. They can individually cause memory problems beyond just the fatigue aspect of it. It's a very complicated thing to try to tease out.
That's exactly what I was going to say, because there's also aging and menopause, and there's other things that could be factors too that could affect memory, not just migraine. So I guess it is difficult to tease apart sometimes.
As you said, you know, if we try to focus on the people with infrequent episodic migraine, maybe that'll help us understand it better, because it takes away perhaps some of the effects of the last attack, right? If someone only has, I never see this person, one attack a year, why would you wait 3 months to see me if all you have is one attack a year? I'm not trying to minimize that, of course, but someone should have taken better care of that person.
I'd like to talk about potential long-term effects of migraine. And there is a new study out about chronic pain and premature aging of the brain and Alzheimer's in patients 60 plus. What do you think this means for people with chronic migraine?
We're all aging, hopefully, meaning getting to do so. And it's very intertangled, because not everyone with migraine, as they get older, outgrows them. I certainly have people with chronic migraine that I treat who are in their 80s, and I have to kind of semi-jokingly say, it doesn't look like you're going to outgrow this. I don't think that there's much evidence, in fact, there's no evidence that I can see, that the MRI little white dots that we see commonly in migraine predict any dementia. In fact, there was a very nice study, I think it was probably almost a decade ago by now, the Dutch camera study, where they imaged a group of people with and without migraine, identified that yes, migraine is associated with these visible changes on MRI, and then they followed them over time. There was no evidence that predicted cognitive decline, stroke, and so forth. So, you know, newer studies are showing us more and more information, and I don't think the answers are really solid yet, but I feel very comfortable reassuring my patients with migraine that their migraines are not likely to lead to dementia. Yes, there's stroke risk that's associated with migraine, and that's a whole separate aspect of what we try to mitigate with the patients. And that good care, at least hopefully, will at the very minimum minimize their migraines and minimize their sense that they're going to dwindle cognitively over time.
Well, that's a relief to me, and I think to a lot of people, that there's nothing showing otherwise at this time, that hopefully, you know, migraine or chronic migraine isn't directly linked to dementia.
Yes.
Okay, great. I think you kind of touched on this earlier, but does the brain change in size during chronic migraine? And are there ways to have it return to its original size if we're managing our migraine better?
Certainly in other pain states, there's been evidence that treatment can potentially reverse the morphologic changes, the structural changes. I came across a study about treatment of low back pain, and they had shown that areas of the brain that were smaller in size after treatment seemed to get back towards normal. There's evidence that in people with migraine, there are structural changes, and again, whether they're cause or effect is still uncertain, but at least we don't see that our treatments are worsening them. And I think it's too early to say that our treatments are going to structurally reverse changes, whether they're cause or effect. As far as what we can do, well, first of all, there's so many different treatments that are relevant for migraine. When I have patients who have cognitive issues and they say, you know, is there a specific diet that I should be on? Is there an exercise that I ought to do? I say, well, the key things are, first of all, a healthy diet. There's no specific diet. There's no supplement that I'm aware of that has been validated. There's no specific mental exercise, but staying mentally active, physically active, is, I think, quite relevant. And we've certainly seen that in studies of older adults, where people who were sedentary or whose main activity was watching television had a much higher risk of developing cognitive decline than those that were physically active, engaged in some mentally challenging activities, trying to learn something, whether that be doing puzzles or learning another language or just staying active in their profession.
Great. So it sounds like that people with migraine should follow, you know, what the recommendations are for all people as we age in terms of having a healthy brain and having a healthy life.
I agree. I think there's hope for all of us.
Yeah, that's great. Good to know. You know, I'd like to talk about if there's any connection between migraine types and cognitive issues. So if you see, you know, more or different cognitive issues with different types of migraine. So one in particular that stood out with some of our viewers is hemiplegic migraine or even sporadic hemiplegic migraine. We had some questions there.
Yeah. Well, so true familial hemiplegic migraine is very, very uncommon. And there are different genes that have been associated with it. And those can be shown to cause a variety of things beyond just migraine headaches. So for example, people may, if they have that particular gene, get what would otherwise be a minor head injury, develop severe brain swelling. The persistence of hemiplegia can last for a long time. I've got a couple of people with hemiplegic migraine who've not only been hospitalized, and I had to write a letter, this is not a stroke, don't give them TPA again, they just don't need it, but have ended up in nursing home for weeks at a time because they were left with persistent ataxia, sometimes to the point that it never recovered. That's a very uncommon situation, thankfully. What we term hemiplegic migraine often really isn't, in the sense of truly pronounced paralysis. People can have what we would describe as weakness, but it might be really a change in their awareness of feeling, proprioception, and it feels heavy, but in fact they can move the limb. And I'm not so sure that I would really categorize them as hemiplegic migraine for a variety of reasons, including the fact that our existing medicines, the triptans, are said to be contraindicated with hemiplegic migraine, not because they've been shown to be dangerous. In fact, a number of people have specifically published that they've treated people with hemiplegic migraine and they had the same kinds of results as everyone else, but because they weren't studied based on what was then the vascular theory of migraine. So when you think that migraine is all about blood vessels, which it isn't exclusively about blood vessels, and you're using a medicine that was designed to constrict blood vessels, and you see someone who has severe paralysis and you're thinking, oh, they're on the edge of a stroke, the last thing you want to do is give them a medicine that constricts their blood vessels.
And could you just define ataxia for us too? You mentioned that.
Certainly. So ataxia, we can really kind of think of it as clumsiness, the inability to move in a coordinated way, even if you have strength. So commonly, if we're trying to examine someone for ataxia, for example, we might ask them to reach out and touch our finger, touch their nose, back and forth. And the person with ataxia might waver and try to get there or kind of lurch. So incoordinated problems with the rate, range, and speed of movement would be one way. If someone has a ataxia of gait, which my patient has, she basically walks as if she was drunk, but she hasn't been having any alcohol. In fact, that's probably a good way of translating. When you see someone who's drank too much and they're kind of staggering around and they go through a roadside sobriety test and the policeman asks them to stand on one leg and touch their nose and so forth, they're testing for ataxia.
And what about another type, post-traumatic migraine? Do you see different cognitive issues there?
Well, there it's complicated by the fact that people who have traumatic brain injury, even if they don't develop headaches, the common issues include dizziness and cognitive symptomatology. And it comes back to a difficulty with attention and divided attention, meaning, like if we're at a cocktail party and I see you in the corner and I'm kind of interested in what you're saying and I'm trying to listen to that, but I'm also listening to the person right here, I have the ability, if I don't have a migraine, to selectively focus my attention, process both of those attention streams. You know, our kids commonly are on their phone, on their tablet, on their computer, watching TV and doing their homework all at the same time. I don't think I can do that. So I think that when you look at the people who have post-traumatic headache, first of all, most commonly the type of headaches they develop are migraine. In other words, if they didn't have that history and you just took their headache history, it would be a migraine history. So we're trying to separate out the cognitive aspects of their traumatic brain injury, which all by itself can be very problematic, from the headaches that have been induced by the head injury.
I asked a neurologist once about the long-term effects from using migraine medication, and her response to me was, it's better to treat the migraine than to not treat it. But I do wonder about the downstream effects of having taken medication for so long. What are your thoughts on that?
It can be a real problem. First of all, in general, I think that the medicine-related side effects typically abate if you stop the medicine. But sometimes the patients tell me that it took them a really long time after they stopped whatever it was that was problematic before they felt back to normal. That kind of gets mixed in with what's normal when you're still having migraines. I kind of tend to agree at least partially with that neurologist's opinion because having uncontrolled migraine is awful, but it's tough to give a good balancing act, and so it really comes to us to collaborate with the patients and try to make sure that the medicines we use have a net big benefit, that the side effects are so minor that the patient feels this is worth it and that it's effective enough that it's worth taking something despite a side effect. But I don't think there's much that would suggest that being on a preventive medicine over the long term is going to cause brain damage, let's phrase it in that sense, if the person isn't having symptoms from it.
So, of course, the most important thing is to find the right treatment and to continue to search for that to, like you said, have that net positive effect overall.
Absolutely.
Yes, great. One of our viewers, Myrna, said, does long-term use of medication, preventative or abortive, affect our memory over time?
I haven't seen it too, but again, certainly during the treatment with the medicine, many medicines can have memory issues and concentration issues and fatigue issues as side effects. But if that person stops the medicine, I don't think it's going to, once it's washed out, once the medicine is out of the body, after a certain time, the person, at least in my mind, ought to be back to normal. The problem is, of course, when we think about medicines, we talk about how long it lasts in the body, we're primarily talking about how long it's in the bloodstream. But the medicines affect the brain. In fact, if they didn't, they probably wouldn't work. And there may be changes in the activity of receptors, the density of receptors, the interrelationship between one receptor and another, the interrelationships between different neural networks that might take quite a while to dampen back down, even if the molecule is out of the bloodstream.
So it sounds like that, yes, you know, we can stop or end those cognitive impacts from the medications, but it just might take some time.
I agree.
Is there some way that we can follow you or learn more about the work that you're doing?
Well, my practice website has a lot of patient information. My Instagram is all of my photography, so it's really not medical information at all. I am happy to correspond with people via email, but obviously I can't give medical advice on people that I haven't seen as a patient, and that would be irresponsible.
Well, we'll put a link to your practice website then under our show notes.
Perfect.
Great. Well, Dr. Shin, thank you so much for joining us today on the Migraine World Summit.
Thanks. My great pleasure.